Station number 14983, Albert Shippen, Reel 2.
Mr. Shippen, read Reel 2. What was the process of a boy of your age, Mr. Shippen, joining the army? Can you take me through that, please?
Well, first of all, I went to the recruiting office, which in those days was situated down in the Wesleyan Chapel in Old Elbert in Durham. There met a recruiting sergeant who interviewed me with regards to joining the army. Put it to me that there was various options. I could have gone to Arborfield as an apprentice, or to Chepstow, or join the Durham Light Infantry. Well, I told him that so I joined the Thermite Infantry for 9 years with the colours and 3 on the reserve.
How young did the army take anyone?
Well, I left school on it would be probably middle of July. I was 14 on the 18th of June. I went through the process of medical and enlisting and everything, and I reported to my unit at Bransworth on the 15th of August.
So in effect the army would take a young boy from leaving school?
Yes.
School age.
It did indeed. And the day I reported there was two other recruits came along with me, boy soldiers. They were slightly older than I were, but there were 3 of us enlisted on that day, the 15th of August.
Did you have a medical when you joined?
We had a medical before we joined, to substantiate that we had the right, correct height and weight, and we weren't suffering from rickets or anything like that. And then we had an educational test.
What was that, do you remember?
It was what was commonly known as equivalent to the Army Third Class Certificate Education, which I was a throwback from the pre-war days. If you couldn't pass that, well, they wouldn't accept it because you were either had to go in as an apprentice or into the band. Of course, with the wartime, what they wanted was someone who was going to fill up a gap and not just be odds and sods to be carried at that particular time.
Apprentice would be what, with some of the engineering units?
Oh yes, it was the Royal Engineers in those days and the Royal Army Ordnance Corps. But later on, which I don't think was too far from the time I joined, they then formed a new regiment, which was known as the Remy, and then they took over all the craftsmen of that. But you could, I remember that we were offered bench fitting, which I didn't know what he meant at the time, or you could become a mechanical fitter, a motor mechanic fitter, or a plumber, and so forth. Now, of course, the thing was in those days that the army was coming very, very mechanised.
So joining the Durham Light Infantry, you wouldn't be joining as a infantry soldier. What task was a boy soldier given in the Durham Light Infantry?
Well, you are a potential bandsman or a bugler, 9 times out of 10.
But you mentioned the height and weight and so on, which had to be of a certain minimum standard. That would be less than for a fully grown man, was it, as a boy soldier?
Yes, but I think they still had standards, because I suppose when you you look at it, your physique and everything and that was to play a part in the thing, because of the rigors and that you were going to encounter in the wartime army.
Potentially you would be looked upon as reaching a given height at a certain age, which would be the normal adult sizes for the regiment. After medicals and filling in your forms and being accepted, where did you go?
Well, the next thing that happened was you got a regimental interview with an officer down at the TNF, as it does in them, and I had to see if you were acceptable into the Durham Light Infantry. As soon as you'd passed that interview, you then received your report and warrants, railway warrants and bus warrants and what have you, and I was requested to report to the Durham Light Infantry Depot, which was situated in the Bransford Castle. But adjacent to the castle was the army camp, better known as the 4th IDC. I reported to the castle on the 15th of August 1941, and with another two enlistments into the boy service, and we were then taken to the camp.
So you reported to the castle?
Exactly, yes.
Who did you report to?
We reported to the orderly room, and then one of the senior ranks of the band, but the band was also stretcher bearers and did odd jobs and this kind of thing apart from being the band. In those days, and the senior rank of the band looked after us. His name was Sergeant Arthur Plumley.
And he himself took you into the camp where you were heading?
Oh, yes, we were taken to the camp, and we were given our accommodation, which I must say was anything but primitive. We were in these wooden huts, which accommodated something like probably 30 to 35 men. There was double-tiered beds, and there was also a trestle type of bed, which was two trestles, no more than about 18 inches, took 18 inches off the ground. And there were three boards, wooden boards, approximately 9 inches wide each. And that was the basis of your bed. You then received...
That was the boys' bed in the...
Yes.
In the billet room.
Exactly.
Were there other boys in it with you?
Oh, yes. Yes, all the boys slept in the... Regardless of what the... what section they were in, all the boys were accommodated
together. So,
exactly.
So some of the boys were on the bunk beds and others on this trestle bed,
yes.
Is that right?
And there was a small room at the end of the hut, which was for the NCOs that looked after the boys' section. You were given then a piece of material commonly known as the palias. We used to call it the friendly donkey. And a bolster. We're then taken down to this huge carriage, and there was masses and masses of straw. So your first exercise was to fill this palias full of straw and your bolster, because that was going to be your bedding for the time. You were then issued with...
Was there an optimum amount of straw you could put in? If you went over it, was it too hard? If you went under it, was too soft? How did you get the right amount of straw in your palliasse?
Well, I think that there again, the NCOs used to, through their experience, used to help you out in that line to ensure that you were going to be comfortable and warm, which was essential as well. Because we learned very, very quickly that the cold can strike up through the bottom as well as it can through the top. And then we were issued with four army blankets. There was no such things as pillowcases or sheets or pyjamas. Then after we'd been given our bed spaces, we were given a meal.
What time of the day would this be?
Well, this would be lunchtime by the time we got there. We were reported at 10 o'clock. By the time they took us up to the camp and we got our equipment and everything, we probably, boys had special rations. Even in those days, we were entitled to milk on and our nappy break. We didn't buy a nappy break. We were entitled to milk and we were given slab cake, as we were known in those days. At our breaks at 10 o'clock, and we also were given milk in the afternoon, and at night time we were also entitled to a supper meal, which 9 times out of 10 was something that was left over from the meals during the day. But if the ADS girls felt sorry for us, they might give us bacon and egg. And then off we went back down to the castle in the afternoon, and we went through the quartermaster's sausage machine, which was a devastating experience, because not only at our very young age, later on we observed that even the recruits coming in, first thing they used to ask you is, what size hat did you take? And everybody used to stand there with a blank look on their faces because they didn't know. So someone was thrown at you and said, that'll fit you. And then you were asked what size shirt you took, which didn't make any difference because they're all the same, 9 times out of 10. And then they absolutely floored you when they said, well, what size boots do you take? 9 times out of 10, nobody had ever wore boots. So you got two pair of these very hard boots. You got two what they call Angola shirts with no collars on. There's no such thing as collars and ties in those days. And you got what they call a fore and aft with a cab badge. Then, of course, being quite young, it was the devil's own job for the quartermaster staff to find you some resemblance of a battle dress that would fit you without being absolutely murdered by the tailor. And then the other...
This would be rather difficult. I presume you mean that battle dress may fit a soldier?
That's right.
An adult man? So it must have been rather long and...
Exactly.
And the tailor then had to deal with it.
Exactly. Murder it, actually, to a great extent.
Socks and underwear, what did they give you?
Well, if I can just relate, it went something like this. You got two shirts, two pair of underpants, which we call drawers cellular, they were like barrage balloons, to put it kindly. You got three pair of these grey worsted socks, which, as I say, they're all the one size, and I think the size I got was size 11s. Then you got the your shirts, which were then you got three towels, your boots, your socks, your underpants, your shirt, your hat. Then you got two battle dresses, and in some cases, it didn't happen to us as boys, but later on, some brain in the war department decided that there could be a gas attack, So some of these uniforms were impregnated with anti-gas chemicals, and these were absolutely atrocious. You've never seen anything like it in your life. And then, of course, the killer blow came when they tried to issue us with our grey coats. You could just imagine the size that we were with these grey coats, which couldn't be tailored, but they became very useful on cold nights as a fifth blanket.
What height were you at this time?
I would think that I wouldn't be any more than about 5'2".
In addition to battle dress, did you get any denims? Were they issued to you?
Well, we were more or less given the denim, which was pre-war, which was like a jacket and a pair of trousers, because of the size and this guy. Later on, we did get the same as what the soldiers got issued with.
You must have been quite a sight when you tried all this on.
Well, really, yes, but there was only three of us. But if you imagine the same principle applying to 36 recruits, and shall we say that that day's intake had been somewhere in the region of 600 men going through the sausage machine. That evening, the Thursday evening in the barrack rooms, was a flurry of you change in with that, you change that with it, you do this with that and the other. It was a very hard thing to do, to get anybody to look really presentable on the first parade.
So you've got your uniform. What else did they give you?
Oh, we got our equipment then, our webbing equipment.
What was that?
We got a big pack, which was for our grey coat. Then we got our small pack with our mess tins in, and a water bottle carrier. A small pack, which when you were on picket duty, had to be packed with your spare shirt and your pair of spare socks and so forth. Your housewife, which is your needle and thread and your buttons and what have you. Your knife, fork and spoon, razor, comb and lather brush, button stick and button brush. All that had to be packed up into these areas.
Were you shaving them?
I don't think we were, but I think we were issued because it was the understood thing. When you laid your kit out, you learned to lay it out: knife, fork, spoon, razor, comb and lather brush, button stick and button brush, so that odol that was given to you, all those fitted into the slots, and it was easy for someone to come round and check your kit.
You weren't given bayonets, anything like that?
No, not at that stage. We used to do rifle drill, more or less for the drill side of it, not for the weapon train side of it. The barrels had been doctored by having the piece cut out of them.
And this was from a very early stage in your...
Oh, yes, role. Yes.
Well, we'll come to that this now. So you were given all your equipment. Were you given gas masks at this stage of the war?
Oh, yes. Yes, we got service gas masks. Yes, and the dreaded gas cape, which you rolled up and put on the top of your pack, which in the event of a gas attack, you drop round you like a big cape to stop any mustard gas and that from getting on you, and eye shields, you also got issued with anti-mist things for inside you, the gas mask to stop those eyepieces from misting up.
Did you get anything else at this point?
Not at this point. I think the basics was given to you, and if you remember, we're talking about 1941 when things were becoming very hard to get, and I think everyone, recruits and everybody, there was a scale laid down, and nobody could go beyond that scale. As time went on, you acquired the odd piece of equipment.
How did you get all this lot from the QM stores back to your billet? Quite a lot to carry, for once a small.
Yes, well, we carried it. And the recruits had to carry it. In fact, one of the things we did, which because of the enact, and we're talking about August, we wore our grey coats because that was the easiest way to carry the grey coat and to put it in the packs and everything like that. We wore them up from the castle, which was half a mile away.
But by the afternoon of the first day, or late afternoon, you had all this equipment. You had your bedding. You would go back, presumably, to the billet. What happened to you after that, on this first day, do you recall?
Yes, we then started to get dressed. We were then told how to put our web belts together and how to blanco, which was, we were taken to the blanco room. There was a special room in the ablution area. And there with one of the NCOs and one of the older boys that was there, they would then help us to blanco our equipment and the brasses and everything. Learn us the tricks how to put the brasso on before we did the blanco and so forth. And that. Then we went on and learned how to put our. We had. As being boys, we had soldiers' boxes to put our clothes and that away in. And we were shown how to put them into that. And, of course, we were also shown how to get dressed, how to put our anklets on without them being upside down, how to lace our boots up. You didn't have laces, you didn't have to cross them, you had to go this way and that way. And in general, things like that. We were then given a tour of the the camp, shown where the canteens were.
Could you describe to me, possibly a good point to do, discuss the layout of the camp, if you describe that tour, how the camp was laid out?
Yeah, well, you came through the guard room, which was on the left-hand side. That's where everyone booked in and out. And the soldiers under sentence were kept there. That was where the detention was, in the detention yard. The guards slept there. The telephone exchange was close in hand because it had been an important part of the establishment. The building down below the guard room was where the training staff kept their officers and all that equipment. And there was an open shed which was used as a lecture room for certain items. Then there was a colonel's office and a couple of administrative offices there when soldiers were going to go and interview or being awarded detention or there was welfare things that the colonel came up from the castle and obviously spoke, did his business in the camp. On the left-hand side, farther down, there was the medical room with a small hospital attached to it for anyone that was going to be ill for a few days of that. Other than that, we were whisked off to Dryburn Hospital, which is now the NH Hospital just outside Durham City. Then there was the sergeant's mess. Now, the sergeant's mess was in like an olive square, three-sided square. You had the ante room and the dining room for the sergeants, and you had the accommodation. Now, sergeant's accommodation was one or two rooms had single beds in, and then there was some with two beds in, and another one with four beds in, but there was never anybody above the four beds. Then you came down to the workshop areas, which was where the carpenters were. Where the barber shop was, which was a horrifying experience to go in there, and the general engineering part of the camp. Then you come to the accommodation. The accommodation was more or less six of these wooden huts, and in the centre of the wooden hut area was an ablution, a toilet place, and a blancorn room. And on the side of that was where the company orderly sergeant used to have a small office, where you went in, reported you were in, out of barracks, or the details was come up, or where you went to see if you wanted an interview and all this kind of thing. The barracks, as you walked up from then, you could just imagine that there would probably be about three of these six ordered areas in a company. Then you would have the company office and the company stores, where you drew equipment from to use for training and so forth, and where the administration was done for your company, and where you went for your pay on a Thursday. Then we went farther up. You had two huge dining halls, and you've got to remember that over 1,000 meals were served each meal time, which was three times a day, in both dining halls. These were the cookhouse and that. Just imagine peeling potatoes or taking the eyes out of certain things for 1,000 men for a lunch, baking an egg on the morning for 1,000 men. Then these idiot girls had to cut the bread, put the butter out and the jam and all these kind of things. The salt cellars and everything had to be filled and this kind of thing. Make the tea, and 1,000 men marching through, which was some kind of thing. They were all steam. There was a great huge boiler house on the side, and the majority of cooking was done by steam. And you can just imagine those girls having to wash up 2,000 plates after every meal as well. Then at the side of the boiler house was what they called the bathhouse, but there was no baths in it. They were all showers, groups of showers of about 10 in line. And you were paraded, marched to the bathhouse when it was given on the programme, it was your turn. And the sergeant would tick you off that you had a bath. He went in your PT kit, and you had a shower and everything, and then you came back and walked through the disinfectant and that, you didn't get any diseases on your feet and everything. And then you were marked off that you had your bath for the week. Then the father...
So you were bodily checked after you come out of the
showers
to see if everything was okay.
You were given what they call FFI, free from infection. Just a quick medical kind of thing. You lifted your arms above your head, you bent down, touched your toes, and the medical orderly said, right, next man. Then there was two huge canteens run by the NAFI. And then there was a corporal's mess on one side of them, and on the other side of the other one was a wet canteen. This was where soldiers and below the rank of sergeant could go for a drink. But there was no such things as spirits. But in the officer's mess and the sergeant's mess, you could get spirits. But there was no, it was called a wet canteen. You go in there for a beer, and that's it. And it was away from where you went if you wanted a tea or a cake or write a letter or read a book kind of business. And then there was a small canteen run by the Salvation Army called the Red Shield. So that was run by the dear old ladies who used to ask if you wanted your socks, darling, or could they write you a letter, or had you got any money, and usual great spirit that the Salvation Army did in those days. Was a bit unique in my eyes, because they were a tremendous help to a lot of people. Then we had two huge cinemas. That was the cinemas was on every night. I think it cost you 3 pence to go to the cinema. And of course those live shows used to come in, ENSA used to come and entertain them and this kind of thing. Then we had a 30 yards rifle range. And then we got up we were out of the training camp area then. We got into what they called the holding companies, and this was where men had been trained and were being held, ready to go to the next stage of their training, which was to go to Feltham in Northumberland and do what they called Chevy Chase, which was 6 weeks intensive battle training, and then onwards to the units in question. Then above that, there was the holding companies, where men had been returned from the hospitalisation and units that had been returned from overseas and this kind of thing. The older soldiers in that area, and the transport department, which wasn't very large, but you could see that this was a huge expanse of area, and why we had to have about 8 bugle points to tell everybody what was happening.